I'm sorry, Gisela.
Sorry. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. First of all, Happy New Year to you all. For those who we haven't spoken to yet, on today's PEDNR call, Tuesday the 5th of January, we have Alan Greenberg, Tatiana Kramtsova, Shiva Mutusami, Cheryl Langdon Orr, Mike O'Connor, Paul Diaz, Elaine Doolan, Mason Cole, James Bladell, Michaeli Nalon, Ted Suzuki, Barry Cobb, Ron Wickersham, Jeffrey Eckhouse, Phil Corwin, and from staff we have Marika Konings, Glenda Saint-Géry, Marty Milam, and myself, Gisela Gruber-White. We have apologies from William McKellicott, Scott Evans, and Matt Thurlin. If I could also please remind everyone to please state their names when speaking, especially with the large number of people we have on this evening's call. Thank you.
Thank you, Gisela. The only item we have on the agenda today is a review, go over the registrar survey. I would like, to the extent possible, note any obvious conclusions, and this will not be the final say on this, but just as we go along to try to identify what we've learned by this rather extended process. And I turn it over to Marika.
Thank you, Adam. This is Marika. So I posted today on the wiki, and I apologize for the short notice for everyone to review those documents, an overview of the anonymized, cleaned-up version of all the feedback I've received. As you will note from that, there's actually one registrar. I was still waiting and hoping that I would get the feedback from them yesterday, but they didn't manage to get their feedback in. So I have received feedback from all the other nine registrars. I did put in the results for the one that didn't provide feedback based on what I had found online, and I've highlighted that in gray. So I would just recommend everyone to just review those findings and share any views or suggestions on that on the mailing list in the coming week. And in the meantime, what I can do, I've updated the presentation from the last time and basically finalized the results based on the feedback I received between the last meeting and this one. So I can take you through that and you can ask any questions or raise any points during that. So if you all agree, I'll just go ahead and walk through the slides. For ease of reference, I've highlighted in red those things that have been changed from the previous version of the presentation. As you see, not that many things have changed compared to the last one, as at that point we already had quite some information. So then moving through the slides that are up on Adobe Connect and also posted on the wiki for those that want to review it after the meeting. The background, well, we all know what we're trying to do to gather more information. So on the final results, there are complete findings for nine registrars. And just a note here that the results for GoDaddy and Wild West domains were the same, so they have been combined into one response. So you'll see in the overall spreadsheet there are basically nine letters identified there for the different registrars. So, and as I said, I'm still awaiting feedback from one registrar. I think we might still receive that, and if I do, I'll definitely update those. But if not, I think we probably waited enough, and I think we have enough information there to basically move forward. So, in question one, no changes really from the last presentation. I just highlighted here that in relation to one registrar, only in the case of explicit auto-renewal being switched off, the registration moves directly into RGP. It's quite obvious from the spreadsheet that there's one registrar that doesn't provide a renew grace period, but immediately moves names into RGP if they're explicitly deleted by the registrant. The normal scenario there is that names are automatically renewed always, basically. Moving on to question 1A, no changes here. Majority of registrars allow auto-renew.
Just to be clear, Marika, back on 1A, when you say auto-renew, we're talking about the auto-renewal with the registrant or the auto-renew process on the registry side?
We actually asked for the auto-renew on the registry side, but many also interpret this as asking whether the registrar provides auto-renewal option for the registrant.
Okay, I think when we work on the spreadsheet, I think we need to divide those two so there's clarity. If there wasn't clarity to the registrars we're asking, there's not likely to be clarity to any other audience we go to. So I think we need to make it clear and then differentiate the two forms of answers that we're given.
Okay.
Okay.
So 1B, no changes. 1, how notices are sent, generally by email, often to different contacts on file. As noted as well, some provided detailed information when notices are being sent, others don't. And again, some of that information I was able to find on, you know, in the registration agreement or FAQs or other kinds of information, but some actually provided it through their feedback to the survey, and it wasn't obvious from the website as to when notices are being sent.
It, Marika, on that one, it would be useful, I think, again, in the summaries, if you give a range of how early do they get sent and how late, you know, just give people a feeling for prior to expiration, what kind of range do we see in actual practice, and post-expiration, what do we see?
You would like me to add that in the presentation, because in the spreadsheet, that information, those that provided that, it has been included there.
No, but I'm assuming, you know, we may do a presentation like this in Nairobi, or
okay.
Or a summary within the report that we'll be writing. And
okay.
I think to give people a feeling without having to look at the individual columns within the spreadsheet would be useful.
Okay, I'll be sure.
I'm trying to keep an eye on if there's any hands up. If there's anyone else who wants to speak and I don't notice it, then please just call out. Okay.
So on 1C, the only change here is that instead of the actual number, basically most registrars confirm that notices are also sent following expiration. There's one registrar that says they do not send notices following expiration, but notes that the user account does contain an alert. And, of course, in the case where there is no expiration, no notices are being sent because the domain name doesn't expire. Although
okay.
They do send an alert on the fact that the name is going to be auto-renewed.
By user account, you mean if the registrant logs on to the registrar's system?
Correct.
They will see a notice that the domain has expired.
Okay. Yes. So in 1D, the only change here is in the second bullet that four registrars do not make substantial changes to his data apart from changing the name servers.
Is there general? What about the changing of the name server? Sorry, I'm mixing things up here. So four of them say they do not make substantial changes, implying they don't change the name of the registrant and contact information.
Correct.
And other than changing the name server?
Yes. While the others know that they may make changes, and some of them confirm that they do, while one of them actually says, although they have the provision saying that they may change, and they actually don't do it in practice.
Okay.
And 1E, the cost of recovery prior to RGP, six registrars indicate that the RE may recover the domain name at least for a certain period for the normal renewal fee. And in other cases, an additional fee may apply. And in some cases, it's specified that's actually the same fee as is being charged during RGP.
So in summary, the cost of recovery varies, and sometimes it's specified and sometimes it isn't.
Correct, but
yeah.
It is always specified that an additional fee may apply.
Yeah,
it's
okay.
Not always specified in the registration agreement what that fee is. And some indicate that, you know, for a certain period of time, and I think in one instance that period is as short as 3 days, you may renew it for the same fee as the normal renewal fee would have been.
Okay.
and some that's a longer period. For some, it's, I think, 30 or 45 days, 40 days. So one app, when is the DNS changed and where does it point? Since you had basically all the registrars do reserve the right in the agreement to redirect the IP address to a registrar-designated page, and that can be, you know, various kinds. And just noting as well that, of course, it's not applicable for the situation where there's actually no renewed grace period and where a name goes straight to RGP. And 1G, does the page say it has expired? You know, just to change that, in 8 instances, the new page will actually display information that either the registration has expired or info on how to renew or advertises the sale or auction of the domain name.
Okay, I'm confused. We started off with 10 registrars, 2 of which were merged together, and 1 of which does not, this question does not apply because registrations do not exist in this nebulous state. So isn't eight all then?
Well, I've counted, basically for this information, I've counted the 10. I haven't duplicated the registrar in the Excel sheet, but I've counted
it. Okay, I misunderstood. I thought you had said you had. So we're still talking out of 10 in this case.
Yes, we're talking out of 10. It's just that those results haven't been included in the Excel sheet because it would basically mean 2 times exactly the same thing. I mean, if that's confusing, I'm happy to correct that or, you know, either add them to the Excel sheet or talk just here about 9, total of 9 registrars if that is causing confusion.
No, I think it's clear once it's been made clear.
Okay. So 1H, what happens to email following expiration? Most cases, email will bounce and is discarded. One registrar confirms that the email is delivered, but doesn't actually specify how that works. I assume, because in the question we actually asked, is it then being delivered to an alternative address that the registrar has on file? So I'm just presuming that that is the way then email is delivered. And again, of course, not applicable for the registrar that doesn't operate a renewed grace period.
So let me get this straight. One registrar says they redirect the web to their own page, or they may, but email keeps on being delivered.
No, because in the question we ask as well, like if the email is, you know, if the same email address is used, do you take it into account, or do you send it then to an alternative address? So the email is being delivered. I interpreted that as meaning that they have an alternative address that they then use to try to deliver the email. But again, I'm happy to check back on that one, what is actually meant with that.
I think we need to, because although it's technically possible, it doesn't sound likely that they would intercept all email and deliver it to some other address. If you could check in the background. Not now. I mean, but
I'll check back with the registrar that provided that feedback.
Thank you.
So when I no changes there. Basically, it's not factored in. A reminder sent from the same address. No changes here either.
Okay, but what? Okay, so the answer is
on 1J.
Yeah, some say they send it from the same address. Some say it comes from different addresses.
Yes, and some note as well that it's sometimes in, you know, resellers have the possibility to configure that in a way they want, so
right,
they don't have any oversight as how that's being done. Four say that it comes from the same address, and one registrar actually notes that it uses different from addresses to identify the type of communication intended for the RE.
Okay,
that's a bit of a mix.
If I remember correctly, that one was asked to understand to what extent these emails may be caught in spam filters. I think that was the original rationale for asking that, was it not?
Yes, I think.
I think that came from Mike Pelage.
And I just joined the call a couple of minutes late and heard my name, so.
Glad to have you here.
Did you need something, or?
No, the question was, I was just questioning in my own mind why we asked what addresses mail comes from. And I think the rationale was to understand to what extent these mails might be caught in spam filters because they're coming from an unusual or previously unheard of origin.
Okay. I don't remember asking that question, but I think it's a good question. I think it's a good question, but maybe if I did answer it, maybe I had a really good day that day. Anyway,
let's assume that. Thank you. Go ahead, Marika.
I'm moving on to 1K. At what point is the registration made available to others? In most cases, the registrar can, in theory, renew or transfer the registration to the registrar immediately upon expiration. That's how provisions are written. But several specify that in practice, this only happens at the end of the auto, after the new grace period. I should correct that there as well. In certain cases, the registration is put up for auction after a certain amount of time, such as 25 days or 30 days after expiration, after which it becomes available then for third parties. So 1L, if a reseller was involved, how does the RE determine it is actually dealing with a reseller? Most know that the reseller information shows up in the WHOIS database and serves as the first point of contact of the RE. Some noted that the RE can tell by the absence of the ICANN accredited logo on the website.
The reseller information shows up in the WHOIS database. My recollection is it may be there, but if it's there, it's in a coded form that doesn't point to a reseller. Is that not correct? Does anyone who is more familiar with WHOIS than I am comment on that? Kelly?
I'm trying to understand. What do you ask?
Well, the first point, this says the reseller information shows up in the WHOIS database and serves as the first point of contact to the RAE. My recollection is if anything about the reseller shows up in the WHOIS database, it's in a coded form that's particular to the registrar and is not interpretable to someone just casually looking at WHOIS.
No,
to identify the reseller.
No, if you look at the WHOIS output on a lot of domains that have been provisioned via resellers of some of the registrars, it'll clearly, if you get the full form WHOIS as opposed to an abbreviated version of it, it will clearly indicate who is providing the registration services. The top part, which is the standard bit coming from something fairly central, I'm sorry, my brain's a bit fried, so you'll have to excuse me if I'm not making much sense. The central bit, which just is like, you know, the registrar record and very little else, that's obviously not going to be touched, but if you go down into the full record, it should indicate who the registration services are being provided by in some form or other.
But not necessarily. I've looked at ones, you know, related to my own registrations or ones of people I work with, and typically the reseller is, you know, in some coded format, in, you know, three letters and a number or something like that.
But no, I mean, a lot of the ones I've seen, it's pretty clear. It'll actually have a reference to the URL and everything.
Okay.
I mean, it depends, obviously, on which registrar is doing what, but the ones I'm familiar with, it's pretty clear.
Okay. Thank you. Marika?
And then the last one here was one registrar node that provides a reseller information retrieval tool that a registrar can use. Another sub-question of the same related to reseller question was how does the RE identify the affiliated registrar, and most know that this information is available through a WHOIS lookup. Another sub-question related to the reseller is may the RE work with registrar to recover the name, and most note here that the reseller should be the first point of contact for the RE. But most of them note as well that in case of escalation, such as unresponsiveness of the reseller, the registrar will assist the RE. The Question 1M, what options are available for contacting the reseller or registrar? And most note here that it's the same support options that existed prior to expiration, like web, mail, telephone, are also available after expiration.
Which doesn't really answer the question. In terms of how readily can one get hold of them?
Well, I think it's in the spreadsheet you can find as well, because some basically specify as well that they have 24/7 response systems. Some know that you can actually even go to their offices and get support. So some more information there is provided in the spreadsheet. But a real summary to make of that, it's probably better to look at the details provided there and see if there's anything further required. On one end, when does the name enter RGP? In most cases, only if the registration has not been renewed by the REE or transferred to a third party. One registrar actually does allow for the REE to notify the registrar that he or she does not want the registrar to proceed with a transfer to a third party, and in that case, the registration is deleted. And in the one case where there is no renewed grace period, but only if the domain has been cancelled or auto renewal is explicitly turned off, the registration will immediately enter into RGP. And 1O, the duration of the renewal grace period provided by the registrar to the registrants. And this ranges from 0, as noted in the one case where there's actually no renewed grace period provided, to 30, 35, 40, 42 days, respectively.
Now, during those periods, various things may have happened to the domain name, but they are still retrievable, even if the auction has begun or things like that, is the implication.
Correct.
Okay. Barry, you have your hand up?
Yes, it's Barry. Thank you. Can you just clarify again why the word auto is being crossed out here?
Because that caused confusion, and it's not an auto-renewal at that stage. The auto-renewal is related to the process between the registrar and the registry. And here we're talking really about the renewal grace period that a registrar may provide to the registrants in which they can recover or redeem their domain name.
I think this is one of the things that when we start working on the report, we're going to have to be very careful about defining our capitalized terms. I mean, many registrars do have the concept of an auto-renewal with the registrant. That's a registrant registry, a registrant registrar relationship that you deposit your credit card and they will renew it, but that's quite distinct from the formally ICANN defined auto renewal.
And so, just to I guess perhaps refresh my memory, at the beginning of our working group there was this GPLD lifecycle picture that's being used. Maybe it was part of the issues report. But it specifically calls out an auto-renew grace period. Just to confirm, that is strictly presented between the registry and registrar.
Correct.
And not to the registrant at all.
That's correct. Well, it implies what the registrar can do with the registrant, because they have to do something within 45 days.
Okay.
But it doesn't define what it is they do. It just does define an overall time period, if I remember correctly.
Okay. So we're calling it RGP here for the purpose of this exercise, and we're lumping it all together as just being renewal grace period, but that is still different than from redemption grace period, correct?
Yes.
That's correct. I mean, I coined it here about renewal grace period because most registrars call it something differently. Some call it renewal grace period. There are different terms that are being used by the different registrars. So I tried to give it a term, that hopefully explains what is intended. But if anyone has a better suggestion on how we should call it to make clear what is meant with it,
What you're talking about here is the period during which the registrant has an opportunity to renew post-expiration.
Correct.
So.
Okay. Okay. Thank you. I guess, yes, I'd just like to note for the record that I strongly suggest if we had the opportunity to improve upon the naming conventions, both from a registrant perspective versus the registrar or registry perspective, I think we should, because I'm trying to draw a picture of what I'm kind of expanding on the GTLD life cycle that was presented to us. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I've confused the hell out of myself, and hence why I'm partially asking the question. And now I've understood that, so for sure when we go to present this to the community, we have to make this absolutely crystal clear, especially if this eventually filters down to the registrant, because it's just going to add to the confusion, I think. So, thank you.
I think we have no choice but to support that concept, and when we start writing, to do our best to make it difficult for people to be confused. It's a confusing enough process as it is without using the same words multiple different ways and the same phrases multiple different ways. Barry, is that a new hand? No, it's an old hand. Okay. Okay, Marika?
Okay, so moving on to question two, what if explicit instructions are given not to renew the registration? Most registrars follow the same procedure as for no notice given. And only in one instance where there's no renewed grace period domain, if the domain has been cancelled explicitly from the registrar system, it will not be renewed and go straight to RGP. Question two A, how is the request for deletion prior to expiration dealt with? Most registrars here indicate that the registration is immediately deleted upon request or treated differently from an expired registration. But those that note that actually don't provide further details as to what that means, treating differently. Only one registrar indicates that it will treat it as a normal expired registration.
Okay, thank you.
So three, where can information concerning expiration deletion be found? Nothing has really changed here. In most cases, information is contained in the registration agreement. Some registrars provide additional information in FAQs, in a help center, or deletion renewal policy documents. It's not always obvious where to find the information. It's taken me quite some searching to actually find the relevant sections or documents. As discussed last time as well, language and registration agreement is often too legal to be clear, and often not specific enough, for understandable reasons. If it's a legal document, sort of many terms may not, in its sole discretion, no guarantee, it can change without notice, which doesn't really provide a clear picture of what actually happens in practice. But in some instances, that kind of information is provided in supporting documents. And in certain cases, the language in registration agreements actually does not seem to match the actual practice. There have been several instances where the registration agreement basically notes that the registrar may redirect the DNS, but then says in practice, we actually don't do that. In some cases, it seems that they have provisions like that to have that possibility in case they would like to do so or decide to do so, but do not always make use of it in practice.
Marika, back to what you just said. I thought all registrars, with the exception of the one that immediately goes to the RGP, do redirect the page. Are you saying now some don't, or the timing of that may vary?
The timing may vary. And I think, I was more talking to you about the confusion there, on the one that said no substantial changes were made. One basically had in the registration agreement, the provision that, they were entitled to make any changes to the details, including registrant information. But then in the feedback they provided, and it was not information I found anywhere else in the registration agreement or the document, did they actually say, well, but in practice we don't do that. We actually only change the name servers and leave
okay.
The rest.
Okay. Because my recollection is, in fact, that's correct, though, that some registrars change the name servers, but do not do it immediately. But all of them ultimately do change it.
Yeah, I think if you look in the spreadsheet, some provide specific dates. I think I recall one in one case like after 12 days or something like that, where they actually changed the name service.
Okay.
Question four, if a registrar makes changes to who is, does it depend on the registry charging or not? And all respondents actually indicate that this does not have an impact. Question five, is there a right for the RAE to remove the domain?
Marika, can we go back to the previous one? I have a question for the registrars. When that question was originally asked, it was to try to understand to what extent having a the auto-renewal grace period and prepaying for that period was an issue. The results indicate it's not an issue, but I believe several registrars in conversations on this mailing list, on this teleconference, have said that, but if the rules for .com and .net, that is the majority of registrations, would change, that might change their business practices. Do we need to, it's a question I'm asking of the registrars on the list, do we need to reflect that in these deliberations? Because the question as asked and answered implies it makes no difference whether the registries charge the registrar at the beginning of the period for the next year or not. My recollection of the conversations is it made well if it was done in a larger scale, James.
Yes, Alan, this is James. I guess I'm not clear on what it is that you're asking. If the auto-renew grace period were to go away, or we were to be charged at the end of the 45-day period as opposed to the beginning,
would it change?
Go ahead.
Yeah, let's say at the end instead of the beginning.
I don't know that I would have a definitive answer on whether or not that would change our business practice. I can tell you that some country codes do operate that way. And I think for consistency, we treat them the same as Common Net and the other GTLDs.
Yeah. I guess what I'm asking is do you have any concern? I wasn't asking for a definitive answer on how you would change your business practices, but do you have any concern that this answer may misrepresent the reality?
Answer to number four?
Yeah.
That's on the screen now? I don't know that that's really having an impact.
Okay, so it's not a...
Yeah, Jeff has his hand up, though. He may be able to...
Jeff?
My hand was up to try and get some further explanation on the question, and also to say that, you know what, Alan, I think if you send it out in an email, let us just think about it, because I'm still unclear of the question and how it comes through. I know you explained it. I guess probably I just need to think about it. Maybe some of the others do, I think, because normally we're kind of talkative, and I think the silence on this is not because we're – I know myself. It's not. I'm just still trying to work this out in my head. So maybe for the next call we could think about a response for this.
Okay. I'm
not
sure it's critical. I just want to make sure that – you know, we don't go off on a tangent and say we can change this because it won't have any effect on the registrant if indeed that is not the case. And I may not be awake enough to formulate the question properly, and I'll try to think about it. But I thought there were some things said many, many weeks ago that...
Alan, this is James.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do recall us having a conversation where we speculated what the impact would be on smaller registrars who maybe... would have a cash flow impact, and we also talked about possibly how this might impact the registries, but I don't know that any of us specifically stuck our necks out there, and that would be very uncharacteristic of us to say that it did or did not.
A change would have a positive cash flow impact on the registrar, not a negative one, because right now the money is being taken.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, Michele?
No, pretty much the same as what James is saying. I mean, I have a recollection of this coming up in a conversation. Whatever we discussed didn't have such a huge impact on me that I actually recall the details of what we discussed. So obviously it wasn't anything that memorable.
Based on our discussion today, I would think it would have a positive impact, not a negative. But somehow my instinct was it was in the opposite direction, so let's just go on.
Yeah.
Okay, so moving on then to question five. Is there a right for the RE to remove the domain name from auction or sale? In five cases, the RE can remove the domain name from the auction sale by actually renewing the registration. One registrar confirms that if the RE has notified the registrar that he or she does not want to proceed with a transfer to a third party, the domain name will be deleted. And in two cases, the RE cannot remove or recover the domain name from the auction or sale.
How does the last bullet relate to the fact that it was reported that in all cases the registrant can still recover the name up to at least 30 days or so? So this implies that an auction period post that, whatever that period is, they may not be able to recover.
Correct.
Okay.
And question six, how many REs have used the right to recover name from sale or auction? And there's no data available on this item.
Okay.
And I added a question there on is the transfer of a domain name during the renewed grace period allowed? I didn't get feedback on from all registrars on this, or wasn't able either to find that information in all cases, but in certain cases this is possible, although in some instances this is actually only after the domain name has been renewed, and then you basically have to follow the normal transfer procedure.
Okay, now, technically that is in violation of the RAA, is it not? My recollection is the RAA specifically allows one to continue to, or if not the RAA, then I know statements were made when the EDDP was brought in that renewal or transfer during the auto, during the post expiration time is allowed. Michele? Is Michele there?
I was trying to get myself off mute and my phone wasn't behaving. Alan, what are you saying is in breach of the RAA? I'm trying to understand what you're saying is
my,
in breach.
My recollection is, and it may not be the RAA, but my recollection is that very explicit statements have been made that transfer is allowed post-expiration, although the change to who is may make it virtually impossible to actually carry out. And so my question is this implying a violation of some of the terms? Is that everybody or just me? No.
Everybody. I don't know who that is in the screen. I can't hear properly.
Yeah.
Oh, that stopped. Okay. I'd have to wade in here on the grounds that I have the pleasure, displeasure, honor, or something of being the chair of the IRTP working group, and that's the first time I've heard anybody suggest that anything along the lines of it being a breach of the RAA. Any discussions that we've had in that group, and James I know is in the group as well, and Mike have a better recollection of the discussions than I've had. The policy at present, I think it, from my recollection, and I could be corrected, allows for certain things, but there's nothing anywhere that you have to do it or have to do anything in that area. James?
Yeah, this is James, and I'm trying to figure out exactly where that might be in breach, Alan. And I did find a specific mention of, I think, this scenario in the IRTP policy, which includes one of the legitimate reasons why a registrar of record can deny a transfer request. It's reason number five, no payment for previous registration period, including credit card chargeback, if the domain is past its expiration date, or for previous or current registration period, the domain name has not yet expired.
Okay, but that says if you haven't paid for year one, at the end of year one, you can't transfer the registrar at that point, which...
Yeah, and then certainly you cannot deny a transfer for non-payment of a pending or future registration period, which may apply to the auto renew grace period. But I see Jeff has his hand up, so I'm gonna defer to him while I continue to read this.
Yeah, okay. Just quickly, that Alan, what you were asking is that it does not, because we look at, you know, all the times of the transfers and what happens, and we know that there is a huge there's an outflow and an inflow of domains that are being transferred during their expiration period. I know that this was a topic among registrars ourselves. I believe it was probably about a year and a half ago, 2 years ago, because some registrars were blocking. Some of the of course, as you can imagine, the losing registrar would block the transfer during the grace auto renew grace period, and the clarification was sent out by ICANN just saying you cannot block it, that you have to allow it, and I have not seen any complaints or any issues since that point, so I don't think that there's any effectively blocking of transfers during the auto renew grace period.
But the answer that Marika has implies that there are people who are not honoring it until after the renewal. That's what prompted the question.
Where do you see that?
Alan, this is James. I think we're mixing our terminology here a little bit, because we're talking about the auto renew grace period, and I think the question is saying renewal grace period, which is that offered by the registrar. Is that correct?
Marika, can you weigh in and tell us what you're talking about?
Oh, good point, James.
This is the period provided by the registrar to the registrant, where they can still renew or recover their domain name.
So it's implicitly within the formal auto-renew grace period, but you're talking about the registrant-registrar relationship.
Correct.
It technically, of course, has to be within the 45-day auto-renew grace period also. Mikey?
He might be on mute.
Let's see if we can fix that.
I'm on mute?
No, you're not on mute. Mikey has his hand up and he's not talking.
Oh. How about now?
Now you're talking.
Oh, good. Sorry. I have a modest proposal.
Okay.
I think we need a picture of all this with arrows and boxes and correct names of things. And my buddy Barry is starting to work on one. Actually got a darn fine first draft, but he needs some subject matter expert help. And I'm curious if we could recruit a few subject matter expert types to help Barry, and I'll join in on that as well, to try and get a picture drawn.
I would
for the next meeting.
It's Alan. I would certainly volunteer to the extent that I could be called an expert.
Barry, have I just volunteered you for something you don't want to do?
That's a good time to ask him.
Yeah, Martin. Well, you know, it's always better to beg forgiveness than ask permission. So
I think, and from my world, this is Barry, from my world, they call that voluntold.
Yeah,
instead of volunteered.
No, or volun entrapped, or...
Yes, Mikey is correct. We are working on a picture that is to kind of drill down from the GPLD diagram that was presented to us in the earlier stages, and specifically this diagram is going to break apart by a swim lane process model meant to kind of draw us a picture from the beginning to the end of a domain name life cycle, and really almost kind of term it as cradle to cradle, because once the domain gets put out onto the drop and made available for re-registration, you could really call that kind of going back to the start from a process perspective. But within these swim lanes, there are roles
such as registrant, registrar, registry, ICANN, IANA, etc. And it would be nice to get SMEs or subject matter experts from each one of those roles and literally help kind of fill in the blanks. What we've got up to this point is the moment a domain expires. And again, this is still at a very high level, but meant to show the high-level activities that occur from the moment a registrant determines that he or she wants that domain name through the transaction and what actually takes place across each one of those roles to when we pass over into expiration and what occurs through the renewal grace period versus auto-renew grace period versus redemption grace period until it's expired.
Do we have any volunteers?
This is Mikey again. We need somebody from the registrar gang.
Mm-hmm.
No, not for any reason other than the fact that it's just pure expertise. We need somebody who's really familiar with how this all works to help us out, at least to verify this.
How are you going to try to address the fact that the actual diagram varies from registrar to registrar?
This is in that cross that bridge when we come to it thing.
Well, this is Barry. I would say this is kind of my forte is the process model diagrams that I try to create are meant to accommodate as much of the varying transactions as possible. And so the idea is that we would generate use cases that collectively represent what those variances are and traverse that use case from start to end and make sure that we've got all the high-level activities, and we continue to modify that process diagram until we accommodate as much as possible. Sometimes it becomes so complex that it's not useful, and so you graduate to a higher level. But that, again, that's where I need the expertise because I really don't have on-hand experience or first-hand knowledge of what really occurs after a domain has expired, except really from a registrant perspective. But I personally have never had to try to recover a domain name or let one expire that I didn't mean to on purpose.
Well, on the chat, we have James saying they're quiet for a reason. Jeff has his hand up.
Yeah, I'm just, we're asking for all this work, for people, for input from other people here from the registrars. I'm still not sure what the purpose is, that if we have this, what it's going to serve, how does that help, and, to put all the time in to do all this, and especially, when you're saying, well, part of it is, hey, let's do a diagram, and we'll cross that bridge when we do registrar to registrar. Well, I don't want to have, 800 separate diagrams for each registrar because I'd have to say almost everybody has a little tweak on it. And so I'm just, even if there's only, let's say, 10 different models that cover most of the registrars, I don't understand. I'm just trying to figure out before anybody commits to this work, what's the purpose, what's the end use of this, and how will it help us in the whole, this whole discussion in PDP, because that's what I'm just trying to wrap my head around.
This is Mikey. Let me jump in on that since it's my modest suggestion. I think that one of the issues that we're dealing with here is that there are a lot of different use cases, to use Barry's terms, a lot of different paths through the process. The process itself is terribly in need of being defined. What things come first, what things come later, what phase of the various and sundry renewal grace periods do the activities happen in, what things are bound by the contracts and what things are simply best practices. No, I don't want to expose people's secret business processes. I know that's why James is concerned. But, gracious, we've been through this slide deck at least four times. And each time we go through it, we have these long conversations trying to clarify it. And we need to capture that. We can't simply keep going through this deck over and over again and clarifying them in spoken conversations but not writing the stuff down. That's my frustration right now, is that we have...
Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off.
Sorry,
I thought you were done.
No, it's the lag on my voice. I'm nearly done. It's just the rant that says, look, you know, this isn't trying to expose secret stuff. This is simply trying to come to agreed terminology and an agreed sequence of events. I think one of the most useful documents for me was Rob Hall's original diagram that we kicked this off with. But it's clear that that diagram is way too simple. There's a lot more going on than what's in his picture, and we need to redraw that picture. That's all.
Okay, so thank you for that. That I do understand that, and I can see a difference because there are a multitude of business practices here, and it is tough to understand. And I do agree, Rob, that even though I had some problems with Rob's for other reasons, but I agree it's simple. It doesn't really cover what goes on here. But in the point of, you know, of what we're doing, I think if we had this down, would this still help solve the initial problem, why this working group was put together, or is, you know, because I just want to go back to what was the original focus of this working group, why we're here, and if we have that, will it help solve that, or is this more of, I think it's a separate issue that, you know, let's say that people were saying the contracts aren't clear or I'm not sure of what goes on. That's a separate issue. Is that out of scope? I don't know. That's sort of what I'm asking. Will all this work, that was my initial question, that we're looking at doing, help solve the initial question or the initial, you know, what assumed problem, which, you know, that's a whole other point. But will that do that?
Mikey here again, and I'll jump off real quick, folks. But it seems to me that one of the themes in our conversation sort of revolves around educating folks, not just registrants, but also registrars, registries, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that having some, you know, it doesn't necessarily need to be a picture. I just like pictures. That's my personal preference. But some clear sort of set of fence posts that show especially registrants the path or paths that are possible through this process will go a long way towards reducing the errors that are largely the result. It's errors that cause the bulk of the post-expiration domain name recovery issues that we've talked about. And to the extent that we can use good documentation, good education, good information to reduce those errors, that, I think, helps all of us. It helps the registrants because they now have a better understanding of what's their job and what they need to do. But it also means that there are a lot less cycles of frustration for registrars dealing with clueless registrants who don't know what they're doing. So it seems to me that everybody benefits if we get a set of signposts out there that leave plenty, you know, I am under no circumstances do I want to be quoted as saying that I want everybody to have the same business practices. But let's at least get the framework out there so that then people can describe a given act with the same words. Because right now we're not even able to get the words the same from conversation to conversation. End of rant. Sorry, I'm going back on mute.
No. Thank you. And I think that I just want to separate that there is a difference between, and just to say that preparing a diagram or whatever, something that the registrars would send to the registrants to make it clearer is very different than preparing it for this group. So those are just two separate things. I just want to be clear. If that is an issue and this group decides that, then the registrars would do that over time, but to do that for registrants is a different issue than preparing it for this group. I just wanted to be clear on that also.
Yeah, it's Alan. I put my hand up because I think there's some substance here,
And I tend to agree with the intent of what Mikey is talking about, but with the details of what Jeff said. I think the one thing a diagram that Barry and Mikey are describing would serve would be to show that this is a very confused world. It would be a diagrammatic form of what someone described as, we keep on saying this over and over again. It would show that it is a very confusing world. I don't think it would help a registrant, because there would be so many lines that one couldn't tell what actually is happening for their given registrar or any given registrar. So a diagram such as this for a given registrar makes a lot of sense. The only purpose I think that it would serve for this overall group is to show that it's a confusing world we're living in, and there's very little consistency among the various players. I think the reason that Rob's diagram is relatively simple is it was talking about a pre-2005 world where none of the things we're discussing today were happening, and that allowed it to be moderately simple and somewhat consistent. I'm not sure the effort of trying to get the diagram correct and right, even for a half a dozen registrars, is worth the effort, although the end result would be sufficiently confusing to prove the case that we are living in a confusing world. Michele? Mikey still has his hand up. I'm not sure if that wants to get in.
I'm sure he'll be more than capable of interrupting me if he wants to get back to
me. All right, no, that's a challenge, dang nabbit.
Hey, listen, I'm used to my cat herding exercises with you. It's okay. Okay, sorry. This conversation and everything else is giving me a headache. And this is possibly due to the fact that it's the first week back, plus all the other things that go with that. I tend to agree with... I would tend to agree with what Mikey's trying to do. I think Jeff has managed to put it in a more palatable format, and Alan has kind of reinforced it. Ultimately, the problem, from what I can see, which is what the supposed problem that we're supposed to be dealing with, is all comes back to people not renewing domains in time. If registrants renewed their domains in a timely fashion, we could get rid of this working group completely. Now, obviously, I'd love to, utopia and all that, wonderful. The Registrants' Rights and Responsibilities document, which will be produced at some time in the not-too-distant future, will hopefully go some way towards addressing a lot of this, because it will clearly state, I hope, that if you don't renew your damn domain, the bloody thing will expire, you won't be able to use it, and God only knows what will happen, which will actually solve the problem entirely. Trying to deal with all this post-expiry stuff is completely moot if you've dealt with the issue at hand, which is people not renewing their domains in the first instance. That's all. Sorry, my little rant, because it's whatever day of the week it is, and I'm getting a headache.
Anybody else? Mikey has his hand up.
Yeah. Wasn't I good? I didn't interrupt at all.
You didn't.
I think that one way to view this is that I agree with Michele 100% that the issue is in this sort of layered, complex gray area after expiry and before the domain drops out of the root. And at a minimum, what we need to do is slice that into some sort of layers that say, okay, within this first layer, call it layer A, because the terminology is what's given me a headache. Left-handed, right-fluted, renewal, drop, add, grace period, i.e. layer A. These are the kinds of things that are likely to happen. And in layer B, the triple chocolate cream sauce, add grace period, these kinds of things are likely to happen, and et cetera, et cetera. Just at a minimum, some sort of simple matrix that says, here are the layers of the process. Depending on your registrar, those layers may vary in length, and depending on your registrar, the activities may or not be in there. But at a minimum, here are the layers, and here are the kinds of things that can happen. And some sort of set of paragraphs that describes what each of those things are in language that we can all understand would, at least for me, be immensely helpful. And then I would probably put them in boxes and connect them with lines because I like that kind of thing. But, you know, without something to hang on, I think we run the risk of just going in circles on this.
McGailey?
I must compliment Mikey on his usage of food analogies. He's making me hungry. I mean, would our energies be better expended, though, instead of worrying so much about what happens after the domain expired, wouldn't it make more sense to focus our energies on avoiding the domain expiring in the first instance?
I'm going to just come back. The heck with this hand-raising stuff. I think, you know, the goal is to eliminate errors. And to the extent that we can eliminate them before they happen, that's a very good thing. So I would agree that to the extent that we can help the bad event from not happening in the first place, that's great. I'm for that. But perversity of the universe does tend toward a maximum, and there is going to be stuff happening after expiry that we still need to address. It's very difficult to know how often right now. I don't want to walk into that quagmire. But I think we need to know both sides of that event, the things we can do in advance and the things that happen after, and the kinds of remedy/recourse/interventions that can happen at various stages along the way. If you're in layer 3, it's going to be pretty difficult to get your name back. If you're in layer 1, it's probably easier to get your name back. If you're in layer 2, it's in the, you know, just a framework of that would be, I think, helpful for both registrants who are trying to recover a name that they made an error, not denying that, but there they are. Their business is now in peril because their domain is dropped and they didn't understand, or et cetera, et cetera. What can you do? Well, you're in layer 1, so here are your choices. Oh, you're in layer 2. Well, you don't have as many choices, and you're probably going to have to pay more money. Oh, you're in layer 3. Well, you're in a lot of trouble, but here are your options. You know, some sort of roadmap like that would be, I think, very helpful.
It's Alan. A couple of comments. First of all, I think to the extent that one could identify layer 1, layer 2, layer 3, that might be helpful. I'm not sure we can do that very well. That being said, I'm willing to work with you and Barry, and if we can find someone else who has industry experience to try to see how far we can get on this without committing to finishing it and just see where it leads for a week or two, I'm certainly willing to put that effort into it. Regarding Michele's comment about should we put effort into making sure domains don't expire, short of this group coming up with a complete stalemate and walking away from the process, I can't imagine that we will not end up either recommending policy or best practice which have to do with things like notices prior to expiration. Now, I'm not trying to predict what we will say, but I can't imagine us walking away from that aspect of it completely. So that is certainly given, and the registrant's responsibilities and rights, you know, if it's clear enough and obvious enough, will also go a long way towards that. That doesn't necessarily address the ultimate issue of what do we do post-expiration if it happens. But I think the prior ones are something that we're not ignoring and we can't ignore. Cheryl?
Thanks, Alan. And I've been typing away, so I assume people will read the other stuff that I've been putting in and the time courses that I've been agreeing with what people have been saying. But I just wanted to share with you from a registrant's point of view how important it's like reading a contract. You just want what you want, and then when things go wrong, you go back and go, dear, I wish I'd read that contract before I signed it. The easier, the most simplistic, the most generic type of imagery that we can have available that will encourage registrants and potential registrants to understand the process is going to make a lot of headaches, as you were describing, at least minimised, if not go away totally. It certainly, I think, doesn't diminish the opportunity for market differentiation by players on the industry side at any number of those layers, if we're going to use that terminology, which I'm happy to do so. In fact, I think it might offer more opportunity for people to think, oh, there's a niche there that if I do something, people are now going to ask me, what do I do in that phase, and I can make my difference and make myself more attractive to them. And it just struck me that we do have an example in our Australian CCTLD world where the most expensive domain names, and that's with not even bells and whistles wrapped around it. We're just talking the straight licensing fee. More than five times the minimum cost. There is still a group of people who maintain their licensing with that provider. None of you will be surprised to be able to work out that it was the original incumbent ran the space. It's the sort of group that offers a lot of services, but we're not talking about the add-ons. This is purely the license price. They have, because I've recently let one lapse quite deliberately because we've folded up that organisation. And it was interesting to see their pre and post efforts, pre and post expiry efforts, including their post expiry efforts, to ensure that me as the registrant of record for that organisation knew what I was doing and wasn't going to become a problem for them later. And I just think that that's likely to be a positive outcome of this sort of exercise. Thanks, Alan.
Thank you, Cheryl. Any other comments on this stream before we let Marika go ahead and finish the tail end of the presentation? Then it's all yours.
Oh, the end is precious.
You can tell I didn't know what that last slide was.
So, but as said, I hope everyone has an opportunity to review the spreadsheet in further detail and maybe highlight as well where people feel that more information is required or, where it would be good to go back to the registrar and ask for further details, apart from those issues that we already discussed on the call today. And feel free to put that on the mailing list and have a discussion in that way as well.
Okay, anyone else have comments on the presentation, on the registrar survey? No? Okay. Marika, on our last call, we recognized that we have to start drafting a report, at least start filling in section headings and boilerplate and start putting some substance together in which we can add the debatable parts, the parts we need to debate for as we go along. What time frame, given your other load, do you feel comfortable in starting to pull this together, and what involvement do you want from us, and what do you want to simply put together without us bothering you?
I hope to start that this week, and I might have something to share on the next call, and if not next call, probably the call after, and which I hope to provide the framework, trying to put the different information parts together on what I have, and I guess at that point put it out to the group just to see indeed where the gaps are, and we can discuss the process and how to fill those gaps in and see where further discussion is required. So, if you agree with that approach, I'm happy to take that forward into the next week or two, and hopefully have something to share with the group at that point.
Okay, that sounds good to me. I think at one point we have to start pulling subgroups together to work on the
specific sections of the report and not try to do everything in the global teleconferences. Anyone else have any thoughts on how we go forward in that? Seeing none, at this point we are scheduled to meet weekly for the unforeseeable future, and I'm happy to continue doing that. I think we're at the point now where we're not going to be continually reviewing the same material over and over again, and hopefully we'll make better progress. Marika, what timing do we need to worry about? In what timing do we need to worry about Nairobi?
15th of February.
If we want to have something out for community discussion, the recommended deadline for publication is the 15th of February. But of course, if we're just aiming there to have a working group meeting, with the aim of just getting our work further ahead, there's no official deadline, of course. But if you want some community input, the recommended deadline is 15th of February.
Okay. Do we want to try to schedule a working group meeting there?
I think it would be smart.
Michele?
I wasn't about the public meeting. It was in relation to the calls.
Mm-hmm.
I believe ICANN staff are missing for one of the weeks.
Yeah, 18th to 22nd.
Yeah. So might not be a bad idea just to skip that week.
I don't have a week starting on the 22nd, so which week are we talking about?
No, the 18th.
Oh, 18th to the 22nd, sorry. Your
staff is away between the 18th and 22nd, and there's a hissing in the noise, which is in the line, which is not there.
Which is blocking it, okay. Marika,
I mean, it probably will be difficult for Margie and myself to participate in the call, but, we can facilitate the meeting by having, the recording and the conference details and stuff like that, so...
Let's leave it on the agenda for the moment, and I would suggest if we have a presentation by Michael Young or anything else similar scheduled, then we go ahead with it, and otherwise we cancel. But at this point, let's leave it on the books, but I note that it may well be canceled.
And Alan, for the Nairobi meeting, maybe what we can do in the meantime is send around a message asking people whether they are planning to attend the Nairobi meeting to get an idea as well of how many members will have present for a face-to-face meeting.
That would be useful. From my perspective, since we are not likely to have a formal proposal to talk to the community about, which will be ready in by the 15th, I may be wrong, but I think it's going to be rather tight. I'm not sure the value of another public meeting on that, other than to keep visibility up. I can see, however, where we may well be able to benefit significantly from a working group meeting if sufficient people will be there. So why don't we start with a quick survey of how many people are planning to be in Nairobi, and then on our next meeting try to come to grips with what we do on it. Does that sound reasonable to folks?
Yep.
Any other things we want to discuss at this point, or do we adjourn a few minutes early?
A few minutes early, please.
You want your morning coffee.
I've been on call since 5 a.m. my local time.
Sorry, Mikey?
Oh, I just wanted to take note of the drastic decline of Marika's language when she said, yep, right there. Yeah.
I think she's adapting.
Poor Marika.
It's good to bring people down to our level, isn't it?
Yeah. Yep.
Yep.
In that case, I thank you all. Have a good rest of the day or good full day, depending on where you are. And we'll rejoin next week.
Thanks, Alan. Bye.
Okay, bye.